Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schloem. In 1973, the late environmental activist and philanthropist Alice Tyler, with the help of her late husband John, who founded the Farmers Insurance Group in 1928, established the Tyler Prize to recognize the world's top environmental scientists in the way that the Nobel Prize is recognized for work in physics, chemistry, and medicine. The Tyler Prize gives its laureates $200,000 and a medal, and more importantly, the recognition as what Alice Tyler used to call their roles as guardians of the future. Past winners include such notables as primate scientist Jane Goodall and John Holdren, who served as President Obama's science advisor. In this program, we'll talk to three Tyler laureates. On an earlier episode, which you should definitely check out, we interviewed one of the 2019 recipients, Dr. Michael Mann, the climate scientist responsible for the famous hockey stick graph that shows the dramatic warming of our planet due to carbon emissions. We will be talking to three scientists in this program, Paul Falkowski, a 2018 Tyler laureate best known for his work on oceanic phytoplankton's role in photosynthesis, Hans Herren, a 2003 Tyler Prize winner who has worked tirelessly to promote sustainable agricultural practices around the world, most notably in Africa. And finally, Thomas Lovejoy, who won the Tyler in 2001 and is known as the godfather of biodiversity. Our first guest is 2018 Tyler Prize laureate Paul Falkowski. He's the Distinguished Professor Bennett L. Smith Chair in Business and Natural Resources Departments of Earth and Planetary Sciences and Marine and Coastal Sciences at Rutgers University, and one of the pioneers in the instrumentation required to study the primary productivity of the Earth's oceans by monitoring the role of phytoplankton in the photosynthetic production of our planet's oxygen. He joined us from his office at Rutgers University in New Jersey. Paul Falkowski, welcome to Blue Dot.
Thank you so much. Thank you for inviting me.
And first, I'd like to know, did you know about the Tyler Prize? I assume you did before you won one.
Yeah, of course. I mean, it's a very prestigious prize, so I had known about it almost since its inception.
And how did you find out you had won? Because was it pretty exciting when you found out?
It was actually pretty funny. I got a phone call from somebody who I'd never met. It was an unknown number with a French accent. And she told me, hello, this is. And I said, thank you. And I turned the phone off. I thought it was a solicitation.
And then I do that all the time.
She called me back and she said, basically, hello, you won the Tyler Prize in the first 3 seconds. And I'm going, oh, wow, that are you serious? Kind of. So it was a total shock. I had no idea that I was even being considered for such an award.
That's actually really funny. I never thought of that. But for the people trying to notify folks like you, they might run into that all the time because we all ubiquitously get these. You know, I just got one just before we called you. You know, some unknown random number that I'm not going to answer it. And so it's like, okay, yeah, goodbye. And then, no, you've won the Tyler Prize.
Exactly. It was. She was laughing too at the end, but oh, it was pretty funny.
That's pretty amazing. Let's talk about your origin of your interests in, because you are well known for your studies of microbes in the ocean, phytoplankton that you know have been so instrumental in the evolution of life on Earth. When did you first get interested in this?
Well, believe it or not, when I was about 9 years old. I grew up in Harlem in a New York City housing project, very poor. My father had been, years ago, before I was born, a coal miner. But he was one of the most literate people that I ever met. We had thousands of books in my house. My father was reading and writing every day. And as a kid, I was quite sick. I had celiac disease, which I actually don't have anymore, which is an interesting issue in itself. But when I was a little kid, I was sick in bed, often only able to read. My father would never allow a television in the house. And I started to read, and I would read the Book of Knowledge, and I'd read National Geographics, and I would read and interested in science. And when I was around 8 and a half or so, our neighbor, who was a graduate student at Columbia, bought me a 2.5 gallon fish tank. And I had fish, and I had snails, and I had little aquaria plants and so on. I was taking care of the fish on in my room. And then when I was 9, my father, who took me almost every weekend, every other weekend, I should say, to the National Museum, the American Museum of Natural History, he bought me a microscope, and I came and I started to look under the microscope at what was swimming in my aquaria. And I saw these microbes, and I became incredibly interested in them. And I went to the library, my local public library, and I started to try to understand what microbes were. And that was a beginning of an intellectual basis for just trying to understand origins of life, origins of metabolism, origins of how things are the way they are. It's a child's curiosity that is more important than what you learn when you grow up.
You know, I love that story because I've heard a version of it so many times over the years interviewing great scientists, that it was the parents that took them to a museum when they were a child, or just out into nature a lot and exposed them that way, or to a planetarium, or to an aquarium. I've heard this basic origin story over and over again. So for our listeners out there, you know, if you have children, you know, this is the way you spark their curiosity.
Absolutely. And I have so many of my colleagues that are very rigid, even in academia, they're very rigid. Their children should learn piano, and their children should learn maths. Their children should learn whatever it is. And it's not allowing the children to explore their own universe. It's giving them what they think is going to be for success rather than the innate curiosity and joy of their child.
Well, let's talk about going back into the earliest parts of Earth history, which is what a lot of your work focuses on, and I find it quite interesting. How our atmosphere, how our oxygen came to be, can you give us kind of the short version of that story? How did we get oxygen in our atmosphere?
The short story is we really don't know exactly how. So I'll tell you there are two processes. One, and it's a funny one, is that obviously we had to have an organism that created oxygen. And those organisms are called cyanobacteria, blue-green algae. And when they arose, this is one of those black holes of science we don't know. But they most probably arose around, let's put it in context. The Earth is about 4.5 billion years old. We first got oxygen in the atmosphere, we know, at 2.35 billion. So it took the first half of Earth's history to figure out how to make oxygen from water. When those organisms arose, it's unclear, but it was probably around, I would guesstimate, between 3 billion and 2.6 billion years old. So there's a 400 million year window where we don't really know when they arose. But the second thing is that they made sugar. That's their primary product. And if everybody just ate the sugar, there would be no oxygen in the atmosphere. So you have to store the sugar in a burial ground. And the burial ground is rocks. So there was another process that helped make oxygen on Earth, and that's plate tectonics. So the geology had to be in place with the biology in order for there to be oxygen on Earth. And it's really an incredible contingency because we now see over 4,000 exoplanets. That means planets outside of our solar system. And everybody is searching for every one of those terrestrial exoplanets to see if there's oxygen on any of them. And so far, we haven't found any.
And do we really have the capability to find the signature of oxygen at this point for all of those exoplanets?
Well, we have to stare at the planet for a long time. Yes, we do have the ability. It's a matter of telescope time. And when you start looking at planets that are several light years away and more light years away, the atmosphere has a signature of oxygen that can be seen by spectroscopy. And it requires that you accumulate enough photons from that planet, which means a very large telescope in space. And right now, it's been very, very difficult. So there's several groups, many groups, actually, I shouldn't specify, that have been looking for ozone, which is a signature of oxygen, or oxygen itself, in atmospheres of extrasolar planets. I'm sure that we will find one, and because you have so many targets, and we'll probably find one in the next decade, almost for sure.
You mentioned earlier how long it was before oxygen appeared in our atmosphere, and I can hear a listener out there wondering inside their head, how do we know that? How do we know when oxygen appeared in our atmosphere?
Yeah, it's a little complicated, but to the first order, we see in isotopes of sulfur. So there are four stable isotopes of sulfur. When I mean stable isotopes, I'm talking about these are isotopes that are not radioactive. They're going to be around forever. And these isotopes record whether or not there was ozone in the atmosphere. And we see that before 2.35 billion years, these isotopes behave very irregularly because they were hit by UV photons. And after 2.35 billion years, they behave very regularly because UV photons can't disrupt their bonds anymore. So the only way that we can rationalize this is that the UV light was blocked by some gas in Earth, and that gas is ozone.
Well, let's talk about our oceans now. Can you give us an overview of the role that phytoplankton plays in our oceans for not only producing oxygen, but you know, as the basis for life in the oceans?
Sure. So light drives life. That's as simple as I can make it. Photosynthesis is the basis of life. And the first photosynthetic organisms on the planet were microbes. They were not producing oxygen, and they led ultimately to evolved into organisms, the cyanobacteria, which produce oxygen. And those organisms, the cyanobacteria, were ultimately incorporated into other cells, which is called an endosymbiotic event. And that event led to the evolution of eukaryotic algae, the algae that we see in the ocean commonly, almost with your naked eye, the diatoms, coccolithophores, which make chalk, the dinoflagellates, some of which become red tides. And all of those macroscopic algae, and even the microscopic, very, very small algae, are food for other organisms. So they are the basis of a food chain that led to the evolution of complex life in the ocean. And that complex life in the ocean ultimately, quote, walked out onto land that became the evolution of land plants and animals.
Wow, that's interesting. Now let's talk about climate change and how, because I just saw the UN report on our oceans that came out day before yesterday, and you know, some alarming information in there about how much heat is being stored in the oceans. You know, people that I talk to all the time don't understand that, you know, it's really not the atmosphere that's warming so much as it's the oceans that are storing this heat because they have this high capacity to do that. But they really are starting to warm and acidify. How is the, I saw that like they've acidified by like almost 30% since the 1970s is one of the figures I saw. How is this acidification affecting and going to affect the phytoplankton that are the basis for life in the oceans?
Well, ironically, the acidification is probably pretty good because it releases a little bit of CO2, which is what the substrate is that they assimilate. The problem is the warming, because the warming stratifies the ocean. So anybody that has gone swimming in a little lake, for example, knows that in the summer, if you're in a temperate environment, if you jump into a lake, it's very warm for the first few meters or so, or feet, and then all of a sudden it gets cold, and then you come back up and it's nice and warm again. Well, that's the solar radiation being absorbed by the lake, and the same thing happens in the ocean. And the more that the ocean becomes warmer in the upper part, but it doesn't get warmer in the deeper part, the harder it is to get the nutrients up from the deeper portion of the ocean where the nutrients are to the upper portion where the light is. And so slowly, the nutrient supply will become less and less, and phytoplankton will become harder and harder to find the nutrients that they need to grow. And this cascades down the food chain. So you're going to have fewer zooplankton potentially, fewer fish potentially, and of course, less nutrients that are getting into the upper ocean is going to be the major cause.
You are listening to Blue Dot. I'm Dave Shlom, and we're talking to Tyler Prize laureates. The Tyler Prize recognizes scientists who have made significant contributions to the environmental sciences. We're going to take a short break, but stay with us. And we're back, and thanks for listening. Let's continue now with our conversation with 2018 Tyler Prize laureate Paul Falkowski as we talk about the role that our planet's oceans play in the biogeochemical cycles that regulate our climate. And as you study these cycles, let's talk about the geochemical cycles. Could you tell us what are some of the major geochemical cycles that dominate life in the oceans and interacting with our atmosphere and creating our climate?
Well, most people think of the carbon cycle as the number one, but the carbon cycle in biology is a slave to other nutrient cycles, the primary one being the nitrogen cycle. So nitrogen is fixed by the little blue-green algae that I described earlier, the very ancient cells, not any of the eukaryotic cells, the diatoms, the dinoflagellates, they don't fix nitrogen. Neither does your corn plant. So it's only bacteria that fix the nitrogen. And that nitrogen is then made available to the other organisms. And as a result, those other organisms can form little blooms. And those blooms are what feeds all the other organisms in the ocean, all the animals, if you will. Now, as we start to stratify the ocean more and more and more, it's going to be more and more difficult for the nitrogen fixers to produce the nitrogen that supplies the eukaryotic algae. So the nitrogen cycle is a complex one. And It is really the driver in many cases of the carbon cycle in the upper ocean. And it's ignored to the first order because it's a complex cycle that is driven totally by biology. Many people study it, but it's so complicated that it doesn't make headlines. And I don't want to describe it on the radio because it's not really going to be helpful for your listeners. But I'm just explaining that these cycles, the carbon cycle, the nitrogen cycle, the phosphorus cycle, the oxygen cycle are all intertwined.
And one of the things I've seen as a possible, you know, kind of extreme mediation for climate change is seeding the ocean with iron filings. Can you explain to us what the geochemistry, what the concept is there?
Sure. So in three major regions of the world ocean, the subarctic Pacific, that's areas between, for example, Alaska and Siberia, the eastern equatorial Pacific, which would include the Galapagos, for example, and the entire southern ocean. That's a huge band of ocean that is around the entire Antarctic continent. There's excess nutrients, such as nitrate and phosphate, in great amounts when the sun is shining. And several years ago, in the 1980s and 90s, the late John Martin showed that these three areas are limited by the fluxes of iron that are coming from dust, from continents. So that's where the iron is supplied from. So for the Pacific, it's supplied from the Gobi Desert. For the Atlantic, it's supplied from the Sub-Sahara Desert. The Antarctic doesn't get any iron from Australia or from Patagonia or from Africa. And the Gobi Desert dust avoids, for example, the area in the North Pacific. So these three regions became iron limited. The iron limits photosynthesis. And we have proven with at least 13 cruises of iron addition that if you add iron to those regions, you increase photosynthesis. That means you draw down carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. Now, the one place and the only one place that we could do this to reduce the atmospheric carbon dioxide would be the Antarctic. And the question is, if you did this in the Antarctic now, yes, you could potentially reduce carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. The quote from the late John Martin was, "Give me a tanker full of iron and I'll give you an ice age."
Wow, is that actually true?
No, but the idea was correct, that you could draw down CO2 by that mechanism. And you wouldn't be able to necessarily create an ice age, but I think John Martin hypothesized, and it's almost certainly true, that productivity during the last glacial or other glacial system maxima was due to enhanced productivity in iron-limited areas now that were iron-rich then. Be that as it may, the issue was that would you create other gases in the interior of the ocean? So let's imagine we make a phytoplankton bloom and it sinks. As it sinks, it starts to decompose and it consumes oxygen in the ocean interior. And that happens everywhere where there are blooms. When that happens, microbes create under low oxygen or anaerobic conditions even, they create other gases like nitrous oxide or methane, which are much worse greenhouse gases than carbon dioxide. And those gases would be re-emitted to the atmosphere maybe 100, 200, 300 years from now. So that's not a good thing. So I think many of us in the community understand that what you see now is not what you see over longer timescales of centuries. And, you know, you might be able to draw down CO2 this way for another 100 years. And then all of a sudden, methane comes out of the ocean or in higher concentrations or nitrous oxide. Those two gases would be much, much worse in terms of greenhouse effect than the CO2 that we took down.
So bottom line that for me, as a scientist who, you know, understands the biogeochemical cycles of the Earth as well as anyone, do you think we're going to get to the point where we have to do those kinds of, kind of scary sounding to me, geoengineering projects?
Well, there are two aspects of geoengineering, and you can imagine them being these two flavors. One is you put perfume on the critter, and the other is you take the garbage out. So if you take the garbage out, that's going to be removing carbon dioxide from the atmosphere somehow. The perfume is going to be squirting stuff into the stratosphere to reflect solar radiation back into space. That I find horrifying. In a very simple way, human beings don't know how to manipulate their environment, and to use a perfume to essentially disguise the garbage is not a very good thing. It would be much better if we figured out how to take the garbage out and then not produce much more garbage, to reduce the garbage and to remove the carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. We know how to do that. Technologically, we do know how to do that. The question is, how much does it cost? And who's going to pay for it? And do we want to add that, for example, to the burden of fossil fuel cost? So right now, every single fossil fuel power plant in the world could have, if they wanted to, a scrubber, which would remove CO2 from the stack gas. Every new fossil fuel plant could have those scrubbers put in when they're constructed. Yes, right now it reduces the efficiency of the fossil fuel plant by about 20%, but virtually no CO2 goes in the atmosphere. Then what do you do with the CO2? Well, we can put it into aquifers. We can put it into many places on the planet and remove the CO2 and still have a fossil fuel-based economy, which in the short term, in the next 50 years, that could be an extreme remediation to reduce fossil fuel consumption in terms of its addition to the CO2 of the atmosphere. At the end of the day, we're looking at things like this. Imagine that there's some graduate student in the basement of a chemistry lab at 2:30 in the morning that figures out that he or she can split water with sunlight with a little catalyst that's very cheap and make hydrogen. And that hydrogen can be made from an infinite supply just using water. You can use the hydrogen as a fuel. It combines with oxygen in the atmosphere. You can drive your car on it. You can do many, many things with it. And the only byproduct of it is water itself. Technologically, we can come up with solutions. The issue is the policies right now are very, very heavily in favor in the industrialized world of the fossil fuel industry. So these technologies can be implemented decades, but there's a huge, huge activation energy barrier, if you will. And I'm just going to leave you with this a little bit, because you can cut this out or put it in as you wish. In 1859, what happened? 1859, Darwin published The Origin of a Species on November 24th, actually, 1859. Lincoln was elected president. Edwin Drake discovered oil in Titusville, Pennsylvania. Titusville, Pennsylvania is a small town in the upper west of the state. What did you need oil for? What did you need petroleum? That was rock oil, right? Petroleum is rock oil. What did you need it for? So they started to distill it, and they made kerosene. So kerosene was used to displace whale blubber to make kerosene lamps. And Dietz in Brooklyn convinced the city of Brooklyn at the time that he would illuminate the entire city with kerosene, which he did. So that discovery saved the whales, literally. Wow. Now, as we go on, Daimler created the first, as far as I know, the first internal combustion engine.
Mm-hmm.
And the waste product of the distillation of petroleum was a very, very light product called, which later became known as gasoline. So it was an incredibly cheap product. And so the internal combustion engine was running on something that was a waste product of another source of energy. And within a very, very few years, Standard Oil had built out huge oil reserves. Standard Oil became, of course, ExxonMobil later. And within less than 50 years, we built roads, we built thousands and thousands of cars, we built engines that would drive trucks, we built diesel engines that would drive ships, we built airplanes. All of this was done with an incredibly short period of time. And weaning us off of that can take a very short period of time if we're using waste products, for example, of other processes, which is exactly what I'm talking about.
Wow. That is a hopeful way of thinking about it, that, you know, we are in this mess, if you will, because of our human ingenuity. And, you know, that's probably the way we need to get out of it.
For sure. And ingenuity is one thing. Policies are another thing. I'm not into policy as a profession. But I'd like you to think about, or the listener to think about this, that we live in two parallel economies on the planet. One is driven by sunshine. And when you're putting your key in your car and you're turning the engine on, you're using light energy that made the carbon that was produced millions of years ago. And we extract in 1 year over 1 million years of reserve carbon. So we're 1 million times more efficient than nature was at putting it in the ground. The other economy is based totally on a piece of plastic in your wallet. So you think that if you go into a store and you put the plastic into the credit card machine in whatever store you're in, that you're buying electrons. And for the most part, you are. You're buying electrons that were made by the sun. But you're buying electrons at a rate that is much, much, much faster than you could ever produce by nature.
So you're outpacing the natural cycle of things.
By 1,000,000 to 1.
Wow. Well, I sure appreciate you spending your time with us today and sharing your work with us, because it is important and it is very interesting, and you communicated quite well. So just thank you so much for your time and congratulations.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Thanks to our guest, 2018 Tyler Laureate Paul Falkowski. We're going to take a short break, but when we come back, we'll continue our visits with Tyler Prize Laureates, the environmental science equivalent of the Nobel Prize. And we're back, and thanks for listening. Our next guest is 2001 Tyler Laureate Thomas Lovejoy. Lovejoy is best known as the godfather of biodiversity, a term he actually coined when studying ecosystems of the Amazon rainforest beginning back in 1965. Lovejoy is also one of the creators of the popular PBS series Nature. Dr. Lovejoy joined us from George Mason University in Virginia. Thomas Lovejoy, welcome to Blue Dot.
Well, thank you very much.
So I love that title. It makes me almost want to bust into my bad Marlon Brando impression. It's all about the soil and all the organisms and everything. It's like either everything lives or we all die. But tell me how you got that title.
So somebody introduced me once as the father of biological diversity, and I corrected them. and said that's biologically impossible.
Oh.
So they came out with Godfather.
Well, I have a hard time thinking of when I didn't know about the concept of biodiversity, but you really are credited of, you know, with being the person that really came up with this term and concept. When did you first start to realize that the diversity of life forms in an ecosystem was just terribly important?
Well, probably long before I came up with the term, but there were three of us that year who used the term. We were all looking for some way to refer to the variety of nature without going into a long list. And actually, none of us paid any attention to the fact that we'd come up with a phrase or ever wondered who was first or anything like that. And some years later, one of the three went back and checked it all out and announced that I had been the first.
And so biological diversity, you know, if you were to give us like a brief definition, what exactly does it mean?
So the briefest definition is just the fundamental variety of life on Earth. It's easiest for most people to think about it in terms of all the different kinds of species of plants and animals and microorganisms, but it's also about the different kinds of ecosystems. It's about the genetic diversity within a species, because biological systems are the most complex systems in the universe by far, and they're constantly making new variation, which is pretty exciting.
Yeah, I'm reminded of the great quote by John Muir. I'm not sure if I'm getting exactly right, but you know, when you see a wildflower, you realize it's hitched to everything in the universe.
Absolutely. You know, and that you could start with a wildflower, or you could start with a daddy long legs, or you know, a bald eagle, and you keep following the chain and you'll be amazed where it will lead you.
Yeah. You're also quite noted for your work in the Amazon, which is always, you know, thought of as one of the most biodiverse environments on the planet. Is it really?
It probably is the largest repository of terrestrial biodiversity on the planet. It's much bigger than most people realize. It's equivalent to the 48 U.S. states, and it's just teeming with life.
Well, I'm curious to get your take on what's going on down there right now with the Bolsonaro government and all of the wildfires and everything that's been in the news lately. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, what's happening is you have a president of Brazil who doesn't understand biological diversity. He doesn't understand the environment. He actually doesn't understand that the Amazon makes half of its own rainfall. And that depends on a minimum amount of forest. We are at the point of deforestation in the Brazilian Amazon where it's right at a tipping point that if it tips will lead to dieback of the rainforest in southern and eastern Amazonia and maybe parts of central Amazon. So Brazil will get particularly hard hit by all of that, but that whole hydrological system actually furnishes moisture to 11 other countries. So it's not just what happens to Brazil or in Brazil. It's a big sort of continental scale climatic system.
Yeah, and it has global implications too, doesn't it?
It certainly would have global implications. I mean, there may be what scientists call long distance connections, teleconnections in the global climate system. But at minimum, the Amazon has, in its essentially its lowest value, an extraordinary amount of carbon. Probably 80 to 100 billion tons of carbon are in the above ground ecosystem of the Amazon. And that's carbon that we can't afford to have end up in the atmosphere.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for joining us. But before we leave you, what's your favorite part of your work? What really, you know, every day when you get up, what's your favorite thing to think about?
You know, my most favorite thing to do is just to actually be in nature, whether it's my camp in the Amazon or watching the butterflies in my garden in the summer or some other place. That's my most favorite thing to do.
Well, Thomas Lovejoy, thanks so much for a lifetime of incredible work that you've done on behalf of the planet's nature and bringing your understanding into our world and helping that. It's been a joy to talk to you. Thanks so much.
Well, likewise.
Our next guest is 2003 Tyler Prize winner Hans Herren. Herren was the first Swiss citizen to win the World Food Prize in 1995 and is known for his work on sustainable biological pest control, notably in Africa, where he helped control the cassava mealybug and likely helped avert a famine that would have cost an estimated 20 million lives. Dr. Herren joined us from his current home near Davis, California. Hans Herren, welcome to Blue Dot.
Well, thank you very much for the invitation. It's a pleasure to be with you.
I saw, you know, in your earlier part of your scientific career that you were working in Africa on some problems using biological controls to alleviate problems with crops there. Could you tell us just a bit about your work there?
Yeah, with pleasure. So I was hired to solve a major problem on cassava, or maybe people know the product, tapioca here in the US. And that plant was attacked by an insect, which we didn't really know where it came from, except maybe from somewhere in the New World. It was a mealybug, which destroyed the plant basically across the cassava belt in Africa, which is basically from the west coast to the east coast, sort of a belt which goes just beyond the Sahara and above South Africa. So that problem needed then to be solved. The options were at the time, that was like in the early 1980s, chemicals which people started to use, plant breeding, so looking for resistant plants, and the alternative, really, I think the best would have been biological control, that is to sort of reestablish an equilibrium between the pest and the beneficial insects. And that's what I then undertook in what was to be known the Africa-wide biological control program against cassava pests.
Dr. Herren, I would like to talk to you about your work now, especially, you know, as we move into the future. And let's talk a little bit about what's going on in the world of agriculture, because we're kind of at a crossroads now where a lot of people are realizing that the industrial form of agriculture that we rely on, specifically with monocultures, where you just grow like one crop, like soybeans, and you rely heavily on chemicals like pesticides and herbicides, that's just not a sustainable practice. Could you tell us a bit about your work now trying to move us away from that?
Yeah, very interesting, because actually it's sort of a direct connection to my work on biological control against this cassava mealybug, which when we used beneficial insects we found in Latin America and eventually spread around in Africa to solve the problem. And that shows that if you do things the right way, or if you don't disturb the equilibrium, you have little or no pest problems. And this is what actually is the issue with the industrial and also conventional agricultural model, which is a reductionist approach to production. So as you mentioned, yes, we have these large monocrops, which are sort of freeways for the development of insects problem and also plant diseases. And what we need to do is actually to have a complex system which is very diverse in terms of what do you grow on your farm, what kind of farming practices you are using. And also when you look at the landscape, you know, what is the distribution of the different farms producing different things, including their livestock. And so we have actually 10 years ago, I was the co-chair of a UN and World Bank report called the International Assessment of Agricultural Knowledge, Science and Technology. This ended up to be a report of over 2,000 pages covering a global and also five region in terms of agricultural research and development. And we sort of looked 50 years backwards to see, okay, now where do we come from in terms of agriculture and where are we going the next 50 years? The, you know, one-liner at the end of this report was that we need to change the paradigm of agriculture, that business as usual is not an option. The recommendation was actually to have a total transformation of agriculture towards agroecological practices, which include permaculture, organic agriculture, regenerative agriculture, for example. So that was sort of the start of a transformation process, which unfortunately was way, way too slow. And so I think we are getting there, and not the least, I think right now, because of climate change issues, we know that the industrial agriculture and the conventional one, which uses pesticides, fertilizer, contributes a great deal to our climate change by producing a lot of CO2, while a more ecological approach to agriculture would actually fix carbon in the ground, because we stop plowing, we keep the ground covered all the time, we put carbon down into the soil because we have deep-rooted crops with rotation that include also fodder production, for example. So we know, you know, that we could do it very differently. The problem here is, why is it not happening? Why was it not happening immediately after we called for it 10 years ago? Again, it's because we have vested interests which are blocking the road to the transformation. And these vested interests, you know, it can be very frank here, are big agribusiness who has no interest in agroecology because they will basically lose their clients.
When I look at, for example, the great California Central Valley as an example here, there are just these massive orchards of almonds and walnuts, and those growers point to them as being, you know, oh, this is a sustainable system and we're growing almonds, which are good food, and walnuts, which are good food. And yet they really are a monoculture. They're just walnuts or just almonds. For somebody who might be, and they're making a really good profit at this point growing those crops, so, you know, it's in their best interest for their family to keep doing that. What could a system look like in the future, where those kinds of crops could exist in a more agroecology model that you're talking about when we're talking about orchards of nut crops?
Yeah, you know, exactly. I mean, even looking at orchards, the same as for row crops or vegetable crops, there is a lot of organic production in the area, which may be organic, not necessarily sustainable the way it's done. And I think that we need to really shift away from these large-scale monocrops, being it almond orchards, walnuts. And I live in near Davis, California. In the foothills, I have a small organic vineyard myself, so I know about agriculture and do it myself. I know it's not always easy. But when I look at this mega plantation, which are even being planted today, down in the valley here between Davis and Woodland, for example, I mean, they are planting like 200-400 acre fields with walnuts and almonds and all sort of nuts as they are come by today. Yeah, maybe they do make money, but they make only money because they externalize a lot of the costs, the water costs. They're fertilized. They use herbicides, end up in the water, which is to be used by the people. So these are all costs which are externalized, so the farmer can make money. Even the water is very cheap, which it shouldn't. So again, I think farmers need to change their practice. Smaller fields, much more diversity, with corridors in between the different crops and also orchards to allow for beneficial insects, wildlife to thrive. You know, we need a diverse environment. That's what's going to give us the resilience we need to cope with climate change.
I'm interested in your take on GMOs, genetically modified organisms, because a lot of people, and there's been arguments about this, the scientific evidence is that, you know, they're safe for you. But your take on it is that they are not a good component when you talk about these agriculturally sustainable agroecology practices. Could you just briefly tell us about your take on GMOs?
Yeah, I mean, they are just like another pesticide, which creates a dependency, eventually resistance, and new GMOs. We need to transform the system at the basis. We need to organize it so that we actually don't need those external inputs. And the fact, you know, what people say, GMO, we need them to produce more food. We produce double the amount of food which is needed today on a global scale, which means that if we stop wasting it, if we actually grow the food where it's needed, with the diversity needed, we have enough good quality seeds, varieties to grow enough and plenty healthy food. The GMOs, again, are something which will be sold to farmers, will cost to the consumers, and doesn't solve the problem at the basis. We need solutions which solve the cause of our problems and not treat symptoms. GMOs, like pesticides, synthetic fertilizer, are treating symptoms. And that's good for the business because you keep treating symptoms, right? It's like taking headache pills for cancer. I mean, it's not going to solve it. And I think we have to come to our senses there and say, what do we need to solve our problems at the basis? And if you do that, if you ask that questions, I guarantee you that there's no way that you're going to come with an answer like, oh, we need the GMOs, for example.
Well, Dr. Hans Herren, it's been a real honor to talk to you, and really interesting and inspiring to hear about the role that agriculture and this has really been interesting to me for the last few years about how we can go back in a way to more sustainable agricultural practices where we are not growing these monoculture orchards and farms, but having the land work the way it's supposed to naturally. So thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. Appreciate the discussion. Thank you. Good day.
Thanks to our guests, Tyler Prize Laureates, Paul Falkowski, Hans Herren, and Thomas Lovejoy. You can learn more about the Tyler Prize at tylerprize.org. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio in beautiful and talented Northern California. You can revisit this or past episodes you missed at mynspr.org, or better yet, subscribe to our podcast on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcast groove on. We are distributed by the Public Radio Exchange, better known as PRX. Our theme music is by Matt Schultz. Blue Dot is engineered and produced by the maestro, Mr. Matt Fidler. Our associate producer and owner of A Dog Named Rocket is Ellie Johnson. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.